listening to Inclusive AF with Jackie Clayton and Katie Van Horn.
Happy New Year, Jackie Clayton.
Happy New Year.
This is the Inclusive AF podcast, and we are all about it in 2023. It's happening, people. I have a new puppy in the house, destroying everything, which is fabulous. And that's really all I've got. What do you have going on there?
Listen, you need help for that. I don't know why you got another dog. We should talk about that. Nothing. I've got absolutely nothing.
It's
which
quiet.
Is perfect. It's exactly where I want to be in wonderful Waco, Texas. Things have been great. I'm ready. I'm fired up for 2023.
That is good to hear. I am, I'm easing into it. I'll leave it at that. So, without further ado, we have an amazing guest to kick off 2023. And we are very excited for this conversation just because it's something that is near and dear to both Jackie and my hearts. And it's something that I think is very critical as we talk about just, you know, thinking about the way our society views women and the way our society kind of views some of these topics that we talk about in the corporate world, but also in the outside world, and how this impacts hiring, how this impacts just inclusion altogether. So, Allison, thank you so much for joining us. I will turn it over to you to introduce yourself, and then we will jump right in.
Hello, my name is Allison Rapping, and I'm the CEO of an organization called Arrowet. And we are an organization that works with women who have been and are currently involved in the justice system. And we work with them on all aspects of re-entering into society. We also run a comprehensive storytellers program where we really work with women who have been incarcerated and their families. And we meet with business leaders, elected officials, policymakers, church leaders to really help give a real perspective of what this is like from someone who truly has lived experience.
Awesome.
And so currently we have over 300 women in our program each year, and our recidivism rate, which is the number of women that go back to prison, is under 3%.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Okay, I have like 4,000 questions, and I can just see from Jackie's face that she does as well. So,
well, I just want to say something that I love about the website and looking at it, where it was like, the past does not determine your future. And I think it's really timely to have you on right now as it's like, you know, we launch into 2023, because that's like the how we like we have every day we have, an opportunity, a choice and a chance. Right. So as we kick off, I love the friendly reminder that my past doesn't determine my future. And so we're just going to keep going. We go made it. We made it another time around the sun. Yes. I am happy about that.
Absolutely. So Allison, can you start off just by telling us, how did you get started on this work, and kind of what inspired you, or, you know, kind of what was the impetus behind it?
So I came to Arizona to start a volunteer service organization, a hands-on network. I was started the hands-on network affiliate here, and I did that for a long time. And I got very invested in the community. As I was doing this, my brother, Jonathan Rapping, was starting a nonprofit organization that was about reforming indigent defense in America. He was a public defender for many years. He saw injustice, and he really wanted to build something that was going to sort of revolutionize indigent defense. And he invited me to come to the South for a three-year odyssey to help them build this organization, Gideon's Promise. And once I went to the South, and I went to Mississippi, and I went to Georgia, and I went to Tennessee, and I went to visit all of these young lawyers, and went to prisons in these states, I could not unsee what I saw. I could not unsee that once somebody goes to prison, their life in many ways can effectively never be the same. Not because of the prison sentence itself, but because of the enormous number of draconian collateral consequences and penalties that they're forced to deal with for literally the rest of their lives. And then their children and their families, this is an intergenerational crisis, and their families are involved in this crisis. And once I understood the magnitude of this crisis, both from a humanitarian perspective and from an economic prosperity perspective, it was clear that I felt it was imperative that I play whatever small role I could in helping solve this really complicated problem that's affecting 2.2 million Americans. We have 2.2 million Americans that are in jails and prisons right now in this country. I mean, that's an exorbitant number. And when you think about this, each one of these people has parents, children, brothers, sisters, they're all involved in this. So we've got millions of people in this country involved in the criminal justice system, and it's hurting them, and it's hurting their families, and it's hurting their communities.
I have a question though.
Okay.
You all end up in the same family. You, brother, where did this come out of? I mean, you know, that's just amazing that you both, like, people are so afraid to take the step. And so then you have two, you know, siblings that have gone on a leap to help other people to have this passion. How did that happen? It's none of my business. You can also tell me it's none of your business.
Very quickly, we grew up, my parents were both professors. They were very involved in community. But they also were academics. And I think my brother and I said, well, we love that you're academics and we love all your books, but we want to see how this plays on the street. So my brother wanted to be a public defender. And I said, I'm going to go run a volunteer organization and spend all my time in South Phoenix. And it's just because the action's on the street. And the people who really can solve these problems are the people that are living in these problems, not me. So I can help support it. But what makes Arrowette, our organization, so powerful is half my team has lived experience in Perryville Women's Prison. Mm. And the strongest women in my organization collectively have spent more than 60 years in that prison. So they know how to be incredible advocates and supporters to the women coming out after them.
Wow. Okay.
Hey.
So, yeah. These are the interviews when Jackie and I like pause before the next question because we're processing everything you're saying, and it's just absolutely, it's just cool. So I want to start with the women that you're working with. What are the things that they need, and what is the support that you're able to give them? What are, you know, what are the challenges that they face other than, I mean, you've already mentioned a few of them, but what are they looking for and what do they need help with?
Well, imagine that you walk out of a prison gate having been incarcerated for 10 years or more, and all you know is the orange that you have been wearing. You haven't had your hair done. You haven't worn civilian clothes. You haven't had a job. You haven't had to write a resume. You haven't earned any money. You haven't paid Social Security. You are walking into a whole new world. So what women need, first and foremost, they need love and a hug and a we're here and we've got you and you're our sister and you're here, we're here with you. But they need everything. Most women coming out of prison in Arizona are coming out with the equivalent of $250 and maybe a paper ID. There are a number of women in the Arizona prison who have the luxury of retention jobs, which are wonderful jobs in the prison that do pay. And some of those women are able to come out with a nice nest egg to start their life. But the majority of the women come out with very little. Here's the other part. Think about this. You go into prison. You have probably atrophied the majority of your skills. The majority of the technology and everything that you know has now changed. And so now you're coming out. You may have no money. You may have lost all of your family support. You are probably going to be obligated to go to a halfway house. There are some excellent halfway houses. There are also some terrible halfway houses. You don't always know where you're going to get to go. Then you need to be able to reintegrate with your family. You need to be able to reintegrate with that child who was 2 when you left, and now they're 12. You have to be able to figure out how to get your first job. You have to be able to figure out how to open a bank account, how to drive a car, how to apply for an apartment when constantly that door is slammed in your face because we don't rent to felons. Even if your felony is 30 years old and it was for something like smoking marijuana when you were 18, but you're still not going to be able to get an apartment. So the needs are significant for anyone coming out of prison. What we do is we are there to walk shoulder to shoulder with the women. We start our program inside of the prison. So we start inside of Perryville, and we are very, very grateful to the prison and to the governor's office because they allow us to be a part of the Second Chance program, which is Governor Ducey's program that is now serving about 200 women a year in Perryville. Arrowhead is part of the Second Chance program, and we run a full series of reentry programming for women. Then we have our immediate need. That's the second part of our four-phase model, which is anything you need. Do you need a ride? Do you need to get signed up for access? Do you need food stamps? Do you need a hygiene kit? Do you need food boxes? Do you need clothes? We will work with you to get all of that. Then the second step is, what do you want to do? What kind of career do you want? Do you want to get technical skill? Do you want to get a certificate? Do you want to go right into the workforce? How do you want to work on moving from minimum wage to livable wage? So we do a lot of workforce development work with them. We do a lot of work with them to help them be able to overcome the fear they have of telling a potential employer, hey, I have a felony conviction on my record. And so we do a lot of work getting them situated. We do financial coaching. We do employment coaching. We run all kinds of wraparound services. And then we also are very invested in helping them access the healthcare system. So realize women have had probably limited amounts of healthcare in the prison system. But when they get out, they're eligible for Access, which is the Medicaid program. We call it Access in Arizona. That is a major program. But imagine trying to figure out how to manage this when you've never, ever maybe been to a doctor before. So we work with them to be able to access the complicated system of how do you get a primary doctor? How do you then find out what kind of behavioral health services do you need? What kind of preventative services do you need? What kind of holistic care do you need? Then we work with them on helping them find for them, what is their spiritual journey? How can we help them find the places that they want to go that are meaningful to them? We are never prescriptive in what we do. It is what they want, and how can we help you define your success? We are not going to determine what success means to them. We're going to walk shoulder to shoulder with them to help them meet their life as successes as they want it to be.
I love that. The fact that you're, you know, we talk about diversity, you know, part of it is, you know, meeting people where they are and making sure that you're giving them what they need, not just a program or a, hey, you know, HR spun this up and it's for everybody, but really making sure that you're looking at the individual and what their needs are. And I think that is just such a critical piece. And, you know, I think when you think about the services, and this is something that, you know, we've talked about, especially with folks in marginalized communities, that they maybe don't know about different services or don't know that there are things that they can do to have someone help them write a resume or help them, as you just mentioned, like get, you know, access or whatever it might be. And, you know, what a journey that is to even just uncover what's out there that can be helpful and can be, you know, something that supports whatever their journey is. So that's amazing. When like the folks that are going into your programs, without getting too specific, but you mentioned that a lot of them have felony convictions. Are these folks, you know, that they go into the system, are they younger folks? Are these older folks? Like, what is the kind of the demographic, I guess I would say, of the folks that you're supporting and that are going through these programs?
Great question. And if you've seen one woman, you've seen one woman. One thing about the Arrowette program is you're welcome to be a part of it. If you are referred to us by somebody or you're a part of the Second Chance Center, you're welcome to come to Arrowette. We do not discriminate. Any woman who wants to come to us who's been involved with the justice system, we're pretty, you know, we have pretty strict criteria about what it means to be an Arrowette because we have limited bandwidth, but we are willing to work with you. Here's the other thing about Arrowette. If you mess up, and people mess up, it's just life. and you go back, or you recidivate, or you relapse, that is not a problem. You are always welcome to come back. People's journeys take lots of different approaches. They take lots of different directions. Arrowhead is always here for you if you want Arrowhead. But here's what differentiates, what I'm hoping differentiates Arrowhead and what we're really working on in our organization. One, we have a very diverse team. So we are intentional about our diversity because we want every woman to feel that they can relate to somebody in the organization. So we have for a small team, we have tremendous diversity on that team. We also really are building a community. So we tell people when they walk in the door, if you'd like to utilize Arrowhead for transactional reasons, absolutely, you can, but that's not what we're all about. We're here to build a community. We're here to have you be a part of this community. We have activities for you. We have events for you. We have a mentorship program. We have a volunteer program. We have a storytellers program. There are so many ways for you to stay invested. But my dream for Arrowhead, we are bringing people in and we're calling them faculty. And so what I'm hoping is that our calendar of events is led by faculty that are our graduates. So that every week we have a different program, but it's led by the women of Arrowhead, talking about real issues that affect them in real time. The events that we do in our community are planned by the women of our organization. The major events, the major organizational components of our organization, our director of programs spent 17 years in Perryville. She oversees every one of our programs. If she doesn't think the program is going to work for the women that we're working with, we jettison it. Second woman in our organization who runs our full volunteer and peer mentor program, she also spent a considerable amount of time. She understands far more deeply than I do what women need who are coming out. And then a third woman in our organization really understands the recovery and the trauma, and we are very committed. Something I'm seeing that concerns me slightly is we are really pushing workforce, and I am 100% committed to pushing workforce. But if we are going to ask people who have spent considerable amount of time in incarceration to then go into Walmart or Chase or Coke Industries and have a job, we need to make sure that we're preparing them to really be able to be successful. And that is paraprofessional supports, classes on different things about just how you would manage being in the office. Our goal is if we're gonna send you to go to work, we're gonna send you there prepared, excited, and ready. And if there's an issue, you can call us.
I love, backing up a little bit, I love that you call people faculty. And I think so many people struggle, like, oh, are you a client? Are you, this or that? I love that you call them faculty, and it already kind of makes you want to sit up straight. But I love that you say that, because when people are getting out, like, you need a measurement of self-care that you have not had, like, dramatically, that you don't really know yourself, right? Like, you're in a different spot mentally. And, you know, we had 1 week off, and I missed my first meeting of my first day back because I couldn't even relate to work, and I was out for a week, and I'm an executive member of the team. So I can't imagine 10 years to even understanding, and like you were saying, the technology is different, especially if you're thinking about retail or like food service, or, you know, even working with cars, completely different. And I'm glad that you said that, like, how can we support these people as they're looking to get back into, it's almost like a journey of getting back to self, you know?
It is absolutely, and it's also a journey in which, you know, I am incredibly grateful for our partnership with the prison. We are very, very fortunate. But prison is a dehumanizing place. And so you walk out, you've been called a number for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. You're coming out, people are calling you by your name. Some of the most interesting things are when we take women to Dress for Success. We have an incredible partnership with Dress for Success. And the experience of them having a personal shopper and having their makeup done and getting all of their outfits. And then they're taking pictures and sending them to us of, you know, of this experience and how much more confidence they have. And then to see these women a year later, they are now the mentors to our new releases and they're helping them navigate the ropes. But what I will say is half my team is women with lived experience. Smartest, most dedicated, most committed people I know. I am a walking advertisement for the fact that just because somebody has a criminal conviction does not make them abundantly workforce ready.
Imagine how fast we could solve the world's biggest problems if more SaaS startups would gain traction sooner. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. This podcast is dedicated to sharing experiences from B2B SaaS CEOs who are going above and beyond to deliver change that is noticed. You will hear their secrets and learn what is required to build a SaaS business that the world starts talking about and keeps talking about, and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so.
And I think we have a major opportunity in this country that we must address right now, which is the complete problem that we're going to have if we keep keeping people out of the workforce with all of these arbitrary licenses, arbitrary ways in which you can't make it through the algorithm when you apply online for a job, which is how most jobs are happening. The idea that somebody's going to turn you away before you can even describe what happens with your crime. We are losing so much talent in this country because we are not allowing incredible talent to go to work. And what is going to happen as a result of this? If we in Arizona have a $1.5 billion prison. That's what we spend. That's more than we spend on higher education in the state of Arizona. $1.5 billion. But that's not the true cost of what it costs of people being in prison. It's the cost of your children going into foster care. It's the cost of you having to rebuild your life, rebuild all of your tools if you were a tradesman, rebuild a house, rebuild a credit score that's probably been destroyed, rebuild a whole tax base that you haven't been able to pay into. We are costing people a fortune and we're costing our states a fortune because we draconianly put these arbitrary things into place that keep people from being able to do what they really want to do, which is have really good quality work. And so I think the greatest thing we can do over the next 5 years is help educate policymakers and business leaders about why fair chance hiring is so important, why it is good business, why there's nothing charity about it. In Arizona right now, we have 2 jobs for every 1 person looking for a job. Mm-hmm. Why are we arbitrarily keeping people out of the labor market? Why are we keeping these businesses from having quality workers for reasons that make no sense? So I hope that through our work and through our storytelling, we can help educate people on why fair chance hiring is important, how you can do it successfully, and why some of the things that you might believe are not really true.
Allison, can you share a little bit more when you say fair chance hiring? What do you mean by that?
So fair chance hiring is you, if you have a criminal conviction, you would still be able to go through the interview, you would still be able to explain, and that the company doesn't have a million arbitrary boundaries as to why you can't be employed there. So right now it is almost impossible for somebody who's been in prison to work at a bank. So I'm going to shout out one of our sponsors, JPMorgan Chase, who is one of the founding organizations, as is AT&T, Koch Industries, Walmart, CVS Health. They are a founding member of the group that is really working nationally of corporate 500, you know, Fortune 500 companies to look at this, because what they're starting to see is that this is dramatically affecting the corporate labor market. And we've got to get people back to work. It's not healthy for their families. But there's 2 kinds of policies that keep people from working. One are government policies. Those can be draconian. But then we also have just arbitrary policies that businesses will put into play, some of which make perfect sense and maybe need to stay, but some of which really we can revisit them. So we really are trying to work with businesses to showcase where they could maybe look differently at some of these hiring opportunities. It's not charity. This is truly some of the strongest workforce you're going to find.
Right. You know, we use Good Hire to running background checks, and we're like looking at Checker. We were able to like put some parameters, like looking for very specific things, I like that. It also gives people an opportunity to respond. Like we're looking at this, like this is the situation. We don't have a, you know, hard, fast rule that would not eliminate people. But there's so many times where people are afraid, and whatever the situation, how they got there, you know, you're talking about trauma and then reliving that experience over and over and over again to be rejected. I can't imagine how painful that is.
So I can't tell you how many letters I have written on behalf of our participants to the same well-known company in our community. And it doesn't matter how many letters I write, they won't hire them. So that's where, like, I just think that this is a major, major problem. It is only going to become a bigger problem if we don't start to address it. Because if we make it impossible for people to be able to work, that means they can't feed their children. That means their children are going to be suffering. That means their children are going to enter a welfare system or a behavioral health system, or their children are going to have anxiety and trauma that they just don't need to have, because we create something very draconian on the front end without really thinking through what the long-term consequences of these decisions are going to be on the back end.
I think that's the biggest piece that I always think about is, you know, all of the things that you think about of a job, someone having a job and just that basic kind of human need, and what that trickle down is of, you know, you're talking about your brother's organization. If they're not able to find a job, then do they end up in his organization, you know, being supported by him because they're now on the street, unable to have a job, children on the street, all of these different things. And also what that does from a, you know, if we are talking about government and, you know, government support, all of those things, like there's just such a trickle down and a cost associated with it. So even if you're not thinking about it from the human level, there's also the financial level. There's that trickle down level of all the different things that happen. And I think that's the piece that people also don't think about. And, you know, I am always fascinated by people like, oh, well, they just want to be on welfare. They just want to be this, that. And I'm like, no, that isn't true. And how many people do you know that it is that embarrassment of I'm applying for a job and I have to put this information on there, and that's really embarrassing because this happened 15 years ago, but I know they're going to find it when they do that background check, so I have to list it, or whatever it might be, or having to have that conversation of, let me explain what happened, you know, I was involved in whatever, and it is, you know, I can remember just, you know, in the evolution of being in talent acquisition and recruiting, that when I first started, there was a matrix that you followed. And it truly was, if then, you know, oh, they had a felony conviction. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. Bye-bye. If they had a misdemeanor, okay, well, what was it for? And all of these different pieces. So it wasn't even a, hey, you have a felony, let's talk about what that was. It just was, you're done. And I think there are so many, I'm happy to hear and to see that so many organizations are evolving from that place. But I think there's just so much more that needs to be done education-wise for organizations.
Here's another interesting thing. There's not one woman in my program that says they didn't commit the crime. I mean, look, people are honest about what happened to them. They made a mistake. The women in our organization, they own the mistake. They are willing to pay for the mistake. They take responsibility for the mistake. But the problem is that in some of our states, our consequences are so great that even if you are so completely sorry, you served your time, you still cannot get your rights back. You still cannot get a job. You still may not be able to get your child back. So there's a lot of reasons why we need to make some changes so that we can build a healthy society for families and do what is best for our country, which is allowing families to be together and make meaningful livable wages so that they can raise their children. And that's what we're trying to do, is give people those opportunities to have the families and the life that they deserve to have.
I'm glad that you said that. I've been working on talking about why diversity programs fail. And one of the things that we were looking at was because these things are systemic and you're trying to change a person instead of changing the system. So we were talking about people with disabilities and they were like, well, what required by law, you know, talking about different statements. I was like, oh, nothing. They're like, and then they got so upset and they went off and I was like, go vote. Like, this is nothing. You can tell me all day. You asked me about compliance and I let you know the answer. And people are shocked, but you shouldn't be shocked. And I think if you broke it down by state or, you know, different districts, people would pretend to be shocked, but the information has been there all along. And so it's like, I'm done with willful ignorance. Like, how do you think this was going to go down? And I love that it's like, oh, tell me about your felony. Gonna do about it after you hear about it? What do you have to say? Because you're so completely biased, you can't imagine being in the situation. What exactly are you listening for? You know, like,
I mean, what we tell the women, we kind of have a sense. What it's really about being able to. There's a very, you know, own what happened, be able to talk about it and talk about how your life has changed. We don't tell people to spend a lot of time talking about this. It's over. As long as you are remorseful and that you've seen what you can do, you shouldn't have to keep reliving it over and over again. And your story shouldn't be somebody else's entertainment.
You know, and they shouldn't have to relive their trauma for your aha moment.
Yes. I think that's one of the pieces that I have seen time and time again is the salacious details that, and you know, I am in HR and have heard way too many folks kind of be like, oh, did you know this, this, and this? And you're like, whoa, are they doing a good job at work? And like, that's the focus. But it also is interesting to me, you know, thinking about how we approach this stuff and, you know, what Jackie just said, the reliving of the trauma. And I think that's something that you're thinking about, the mental health and the support for women, and, you know, especially, you know, a lot of them I know are in situations that they were forced to, or were, you know, put into a position that this was their only option, or, you know, whatever it might be. And yes, taking accountability, of course, for their actions. But I do wonder that the other side of this, of when they're having to relive that trauma, what does that do and how does that impact them on their recovery, on their journey to kind of changing the way that they are trying to rebuild their lives? Like,
I think it's back to what I said earlier. If you've met one person, you've met one person. So everybody's story is going to be slightly different. But one thing that I think we have seen some consistency in is the majority of women who go to prison because of trauma, abuse, substance use disorders, and mental health. Usually what brings a woman to prison is a traumatic series of events in their life. And then once they are able to dissipate the trauma and get out of that environment, they are able to rebuild their lives. But I think this is another really important thing, is that people who go to prison are often traumatized people who have had terrible things happen to them or have experienced something terrible. And so sometimes I feel with prison, we are not always as empathetic at understanding. So we take somebody who's traumatized and we put them into an environment that's also traumatizing. And yes, we understand that it has to be prison, but when they come out, we really need to be able to work with them to move on from that experience and to not constantly have to relive that experience. And that's why I think for a lot of women who enter the justice system, they've had a limited access to health and behavioral health services. And that's why we really are pushing very hard to build relationships with our healthcare organizations so that we can really help them get the support and care that they need to be able to move forward.
Well, and then it's so hard to get access. Like, it's hard to get access to healthcare, and then you get access to the medicine, but then you have to have access to transportation, and you have to have access to, you know, get the follow-ups. Like, it's this never ending thing. I mean, and I mean, I think that's the big joke, like within our industry, where people say, oh, well, it's the right thing to do. Listen, I've been on the same medicine for almost 20 years. CVS hates me. They have to they text me every month with the same medicine for 30 years. Like, are you going to pick it up? Do you need a refill? You got to go to the doctor. And I'm always like shocked for some reason. Oh yeah, I forgot. And so to have somebody, and that's having the privilege to be able to drive, you know, around the corner and doing that, right? And then it's like, what part do we own? And I feel like there's a lot of people that like to call themselves allies and like, oh, I can offer support. But offering that support and being a true ally is helping to get navigate, but then also fixing the system that's broken. That's where that comes into play.
And that's why we have the Storytellers Program, because what we're trying to do is we're really trying to be very holistic in our approach. We run a program and we are dedicated to data and metrics. We study the heck out of the data. So we know what programming and what interventions we're doing that really work. Now what we're trying to do is take this data that we've collected over 4 years and bring it to people who have the ability to make change and say, if we can look at some of these things a little differently, maybe we can have better results for people. And we feel that our own women, with their ability to articulate, to be storytellers, to share their own experience, is one of the best ways that we can go to help people start to see what changes need to be made. And I also think we're seeing with this whole opioid crisis that we're experiencing, we're seeing something very different with women in prison. And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot more middle-class women going to prison for drugs. We're also seeing a lot of rural women going to prison for drugs. So what we're seeing is the prison is now a place that is dealing with communities that are really dealing with a whole lot of other issues that are dealing with this crisis of the drug war that we're having. And so there's a lot of factors at play here. And that's why I feel so strongly when people come out, the most important thing we have to do is work with them to ensure that they feel stable, that they feel secure, and they feel they've got other options. Because once people feel that they have options, their chance of success is so much greater. But it is so hard when you keep applying for jobs and that door slams in your face because you had a felony from 20 years ago.
Yeah, I think that what you're talking about, just giving people hope and giving them that, you know, there is another way, there is another direction, there are people that are there for you. And, you know, to Jackie's point, like real allies who are going to walk with you arm in arm on how to actually get to a better place and on a better path and all of these things. I want to switch gears slightly.
Sure.
And I want to ask a question. So I'm sure that you are probably aware, and this is something I saw like on TikTok or Instagram or whatever it might be. And as we've seen a few of these cases in recent years where you have women that were sexually exploited, sexually abused, that end up doing something, murdering or were, you know, whatever it might be to their abusers. And to the folks that have put them into these situations. And I want to just talk about that and kind of open that up a little bit, because I think that's another piece to this, you know, criminal justice reform and the way people think about women that are incarcerated or have been incarcerated, that it's just this imbalance of power. Would love for you to talk about that a little bit, if you don't mind.
I think one thing that people don't fully understand in why people go to prison for sexual reasons. Women can potentially be sex trafficked starting at age 16, 17. By the time they're 19 or 20, they're no longer valuable to that person as in the same role. So they use the person in a different role. Then that person, that young woman, ends up doing something and getting arrested. She's not gonna turn on the person who put her in that situation. She's going to take the rap for all of this. So you have a woman who literally had been abused for many, many years, and then does something really because she's with an abuser, and then she ends up going to prison the hard part that I have with this and why I feel like this particular issue is one we really do need to address is that we are continuously re-victimizing women who have just been victims. And I'm hopeful, I'm not saying that people shouldn't pay for the crimes, but I am hopeful that we can stop taking a permanent on sex trafficking for these women. That they, for women who have a sex conviction, they can never get rid of it. They can't get jobs. We have women who got hired at jobs and then 4 months later they lose the job because they realize that's what the conviction was. But imagine if you were that woman and that was your life and then you're told you were victimized and now you can't even work at a call center because your crime is a sex crime. I think there's a lack of understanding about what these crimes are. And I think sometimes we talk about crime in a certain amount of words that really you're not at all what the actual situation is.
We are gathered here today to give you permission to plan the wedding that you want.
I'm Jessica Bishop.
And I'm Sari Wienerman.
And we're the hosts of the Bouquet Toss podcast.
Today's couples have to juggle so many things, from family expectations to outdated traditions and what's currently trending.
So to make it easier, we're going deep to figure out why we do weddings the way that we do, so you can decide what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans.
You are cordially invited to subscribe to the Bouquet Toss wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcast.com.
By the power vested in us, we pronounce you free to plan your day your way.
Yeah, yes. And I think you just said the word words. And I think that's one of the pieces that is such a critical piece to this of, you know, in, I don't know if you said this after we started recording or beforehand, but they're not felons. They committed a felony. And humanizing people versus putting them into a bucket, you know, putting them into a dehumanizing space. Especially, you know, someone that has been traumatized, you know, in a sexual way, there is such a dehumanizing and, you know, almost a removal from self that is that self-protection mode that they go into. And then on top of that, to have that happen, and, you know, to the example you just gave of, can you imagine starting a job thinking, okay, finally, I'm on a better path, and then having the rug pulled out from under you 4 months later. And I think that's the piece too, that these, we don't need to know the story. We don't need to know all of the background, but I think being able to say, yes, you did the time. Now let's move forward. Like there's no one that can say, I haven't made a mistake or I've never done anything wrong. And so if that time has been served, if that, you know, if the person has taken accountability and done what they need to do, give them that opportunity to prove themselves. And how can we do that in a different way? And especially as employers, and, you know, a lot of our listeners obviously are in HR and can make change, you know, the systematic changes at the top of how do we do this differently in our organization? So I think that's a piece too, that just, it keeps, we keep coming back to that.
Well, and as you say that this is going to be for a lot of HR executives, one of the things that we're really passionate about is workforce. That is because for what we're seeing at Arrowet is if you can get a meaningful livable wage job, that's going to be your ticket. And so we are very committed to workforce, and we hosted an event at the Biltmore Hotel last year, partly because I just got frustrated with the doors getting slammed in the face of so many. I just couldn't take it anymore. I mean, we keep slamming the doors in the faces of these amazing women. And so we decided to make a major investment and host this event at the Biltmore Hotel and brought in national leaders, including the head of the Checker Foundation. And we really tried to make a case to Arizona businesses for fair chance hiring. And in the first quarter of this year, we're writing a fair chance hiring manual with the support of a corporate HR executive to really make sure that we can work with these businesses to help them learn how to do this onboarding successfully. And one of the things that we're going to have, there are lots of handbooks, so we're not inventing something that it doesn't exist. But the one thing we are doing that is probably somewhat unique is we're doing a 6-week onboarding checklist. so that businesses can say day one, this is what you can do, day two, day three. So, because I think they may know that they can get a WOTC credit, or they might know that there's some tax relief to something, but they may not know how do they open the door on day one? How do they help inform other people in the organization? Or let's say you're going to hire 10 women with lived experience, but those 10 women are still on parole or they're still on paper and they have to go to, you do need to let other employees know. And I think we really want to make this handbook so that we can help HR people and managers see and have a path to support the fair chance hiring they want to do in their organizations.
I'll speak for myself and for our listeners. We want that. We want access to that handbook because I think that's something that there is this, how do we do this? How do we do this the right way? How do we, so many folks, and again, this goes to all the diversity that we talk about on this podcast. It's how do we do this the right way from day one to make sure people feel included, feel like they're a part of the organization, feel like they can do great work and be proud of what they're doing and make an impact and all of these things. And it is just, how do we change the systems? How do we change the ways that we approach this work? So I love that you're doing that and that, that's a piece of work that I think every HR person would value and want to take a look at and see how they can implement it in their organizations.
I want to say something quickly. Yeah, if you are listening and you do want to make that change, do not let perfect get in the way of you reaching out. Don't wait on Allison, even though Allison, you're a very fine person, and I'm sure it's going to be lickety split before this thing is done in everyone's hands. But so often people are like, oh, I don't know what to do. There are a lot of organizations that will hold hands and then you can, have regular meetings and have various coaches. And even if we learn these various pieces, take your time, understand that you're going to make these mistakes. And I always say, make these mistakes quick and often, and then learn and then grow and then share what your learnings with other people.
And there are two great handbooks that I can actually share right now that are not about Arrowet, but SHRM has a handbook, Putting Talent Back to Work. It's a great handbook. It focuses more on the tax. It's less of an onboarding book, but it's an excellent book. And then CEO Equity, which is the group of Fortune 500 companies that all have executives working on some of this work. They have an amazing woman working on this, and they have an excellent onboarding handbook. So we're trying to make ours more unique to Arizona specifically, but I feel like we need far more of these handbooks and they need to be in people's hands.
Awesome. And we will make sure to add those to the show notes so folks can link to those and learn a little bit more. So that's great. So last question. What do you want to make sure people heard during this conversation? What do you want people to do? What are the things that leaders, HR folks, whoever it might be, can start doing?
I think the first thing is we have to move to people first language. We have to change the nomenclature. If you watch, and many of us have watched Law and Order, my mother wrote a book, Law and Order is seen on TV, and it's all about the prosecutor and the police. We use language often that continuously victimizes people. We say you're a felon. We say you're a convict. You're not a felon. You are somebody who had a felony in probably the worst day and worst year of their life. The majority of people who have a felony are not felons. They did something wrong. Many of us have done something wrong. Many of us have done something wrong. We just didn't get caught. So it is so important that we think about changing the language. But the second thing that I think is critical is that we have a lot of arbitrary barriers against people who have had involvement with the justice system. There are so many arbitrary barriers, particularly in HR. And if you can look at your company and think about ways that you can look differently at how you ask these questions or what your policy can be or where you might be able to take a chance where you maybe couldn't before. I just encourage people to look differently, because otherwise we're going to have 1 out of 4 Americans with a criminal conviction in this country who will not be able to get a job. So then we will have 1 out of 4 adults that potentially will all be on a welfare system. All of their kids will be on the welfare system. This is a massive crisis. So we can solve that crisis 1 at a time right now by each of us just thinking about something we might be able to look at in our own policy that we might be able to change so we can give somebody a chance.
Awesome. Jackie?
I think for me, it's looking to inside and within your policies and figure out, own what part you play in preventing people from getting to work, and start making changes to those policies. Because too often, again, we blame someone else. We're blaming the victim again. And let's look at what part you play into being a barrier for people entering the workforce. That was a whole word, sorry.
Yeah, no, I love both of those. And I'll mine is, you know, we have, as both of you mentioned, kind of those barriers in place, but I would also take it a step further and say, you know, how do we make sure not just the systems and processes, but how do we make sure that we do the voting, do the things kind of at that higher level, but also educate folks on language, you know, not just the HR teams, but everyone in the organization. And, you know, you mentioned, hey, there might be some people that need to know if they have to go for a visit to a parole officer or whatever it might be. But I am always very hesitant to let folks know that type of information, because I know that it then does cause bias. But if we educate folks about those pieces to the puzzle, that will change the conversation as well, that, you know, we won't be re-victimizing them. We'll be treating them like humans and treating them as they should be, that, hey, you made a mistake. And the one thing I'll add to that is, you know, when I was in recruiting, one of the things that I always was so happy about on Friday afternoon and would talk about with my peers is, how many people's lives did you change this week by giving them a job? And I think that's something that, if we can go back to that, of the path that you'll put people on by giving them that living wage job is huge. And the trickle down of that generationally, societally, all of these different things is just very impactful. So, Allison, can you just hang out and talk to us for like 6 more hours? Is that cool?
I know. Can you?
This
can
is a goal. I love this.
The next time I'm in Arizona,
yes.
I have so many questions, so many, yes, more things. Or yes, the next time you're in Waco,
you can invite me to Waco. I'd love to come to Waco.
There you go. Right there with Ibiza, Spain, Waco. I'm pretty sure it's on everyone's bucket.
Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us. We truly appreciate you taking the time, and I'm excited to, you know, see what else you all do and just the impact that you continue to make. So thank you so much. This is Katie Van Horn.
And this is Jackie Clayton.
Bye.
Do you love news about LinkedIn, Indeed, Google, and just about every other recruitment tech company out there?
Hell yeah. I'm Chad.
I'm Cheese.
We're the Chad and Cheese Podcast.
All the latest recruiting news and insights are on our show.
Dripping in snark and attitude.
Subscribe today wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We out.